Hi, everybody. Thanks. I'm going to start by firing up the audio recording so you know that this is being recorded. Don't say anything incriminating. Or if you do, say it quietly. It's too hard to find after to erase. Here's my newsletter. I'll just quickly pop into that so that you can see it. So there's my newsletter, yesterday's edition. I sometimes put pictures into it. Sorry, it's morning. I've got something a bit different. I've been doing this in my presentations over the last few years. And unfortunately, not as many of you are going to be able to participate in this as I would have liked, which is really too bad. Although, if you have internet access, I'm told there is wireless internet access in the room. Is that those of you who have computers? Is that right? Excellent. So, one of the things I like to do in my talks, because the worst thing you can possibly have in a talk is for somebody to get up in the front of the room and talk, and all of you sit there and listen, or if you have your computer, read your email or whatever. I like to create a little bit of dialogue, a little bit of interaction in the room. And that's also kind of hard to do without interrupting the flow of the talk, but that's okay. I've got what I call the C-chat system, or the conference chat system. It's a very simple little system. Those of you who have internet access, this will... Good timing on the air conditioning. so much for my recording. Sorry, people listening to audio, I can't turn that off. I talk to the people on audio, too. Anyhow, if you go to this web address here, it's kind of hard to see. It's very hard to see. It's not going to give it to me big. Never mind. Just trying to make this a bit bigger so you can see it. There we go. Is that better? That's marginally better. There we go. If you go to that address on your computer, downs.ca/cgibin/cchat.cgi, if you have the iPod Touch with you, it'll work on that. If you have any sort of wireless internet access on a mobile phone or something like that, it'll work on that, I think. Depends on the phone. But go to that site, and you'll see this, and you type in whatever you want to say, like that, and hit submit, and it will show up there, eventually. Wait for it. What's happening here is this screen is just refreshing every 10 seconds. Or at least it should be. I know I got the right ones because I generated the mail. You don't have Firefox in this thing, do you? Sorry about that. I thought I had this working and now it's being silly. Do you have Firefox on that?
I'll get the
technical. All right, because it's Internet Explorer is nuked in my login. I don't know why. Maybe they turned off cookies on that thing. Who knows what? That's the risk you take when you use somebody else's computer. Anyhow, they will show up eventually once we get another computer out here. And make sure you've got your cleared all your private data. Yeah, it's actually the way it's behaving is probably cookies are turned off or something. Yeah. For those of you listening on audio, this is probably the roughest start I've had in a while. This is killing. Okay, I don't know why it's not working. What? It was working. I have no idea why it's not working, but it should be. But clearly I can't fix that. It's just a page repo. It's not a pop-up. Thank you. That's probably going to work now. So let's see what happens here. Well, the way it's supposed to work now is if you enter in the comments, the comments should display for 10 seconds, and then the screen rotates, and you see the next comment for 10 seconds. That feels like longer than. Well, I can't stand the entire talk that I'm giving, looking at that screen and seeing whether it's going to come up, so. Well, I'm sure you've all, many of you, some of you have had the experience of the tech feature that crashed and burned while you were giving a talk. That's what I'm going through now. I really don't know why. It frustrates me, and if you're anything like me, and I'm sure many of you are, otherwise you wouldn't be in this room, what you really want to do right now is stop, go over there, look at the code, figure out why this thing is not working, because it should be working, it was working, it was going fine yesterday, and now it's not working, and there's no good reason for it. And, the problem is... The page isn't reloading, and it should be reloading. I don't know why it's not reloading. It's just so tough.
I can sit beside it and reload it.
See? There's the refresh. There. It should be reloading. Yes, if you can just set this pocket and reload it, we will have a human solve that problem. I have no idea why it won't reload. It's there, it's coded properly. Just so I know how badly this time has been spent, how many of you are actually able to send messages to that right now? Any of you? One? One person. So all this time spent to interact with one person. So, this isn't my talk or anything, but where are your computers? Why don't you have your computers here? Most people don't. You know what? You can buy laptops for, like, not very much these days. Laptops are incredibly cheap. So, but it's, you know, it's, you know, again, this isn't the talk, but there could be more of a sharp distinction here. There are some crowds I talk to are crowds like this. They're the teachers. And there's like maybe one or two laptops in the room. There's other crowds I talk to, and they're like the students. And the room is full of laptops. And it's a completely different experience giving a talk to this kind of group and giving a talk to the other kind of group. The dynamics and the interaction are completely different. And interesting in my line of work, I get to experience both, right? You know, I have the one foot in the fairly traditional community of teachers, of professors, of administrators, the people who think with a pencil or a pen in their hand. Lots of you have pencils or pens in your hand. I notice that. You're not really getting away from technology at all. Right? You're just getting away from some technology, but you still have the pen in your hand. So, I mean, you're not getting away. But interacting, doing something like this is completely different when you're doing it with computers in the room so that people can talk to each other or read their email or whatever while the presentation is going on. I was sort of warned ahead of time before coming here because I asked, you know, how many of them will have their computers? And the organizer said, well, not very many of them. And I said, but they're tech people. And they said, yeah, but they won't have computers. I said, well, I'll try it anyways. You never know, because they're tech people, right? They would, wouldn't they? And, well, you didn't. which, the lesson of which is always trust the organizers. But I mean, the other lesson is be stubborn, because you can still use it to make a point. I personally think, and this has nothing to do with going back to schools and in your classrooms, I personally think if you're going to be doing this line of work, that you should be using your computers and the internet in your own learning. And indeed, I have another talk, not the talk that I'm giving today, although I thought about it, about using the internet in your own teaching and learning. Forget the students for now, because if you're not using the internet yourself for your own purposes, there's utterly no point turning around and trying to use it in the classroom, because you'll be all thumbs, right? You won't really have any experience using the internet for yourself. You won't know why you're using the internet for yourself. So that probably is the talk I should be giving today. But I'll give you the talk that I am giving today, because that's what I was asked to do. And the talk is basically an extended argument on why you should integrate the internet into the classroom. Now, I don't have a clock on this, but I do have a clock on that. All right, so I've got about 40 minutes, and I'll try to give some time for comments and questions. Okay, so that's going to be pretty quiet there, although I know that I have occupied a couple of tech people playing with it. So this is good. So teaching, for me anyways, today has changed. It's changed dramatically. It used to be you'd get into the classroom, you'd do your thing, you'd get out, no evidence, you were free. But now there's recording everywhere. If you're not recording, your students are recording. You might as well count on it. Somebody's doing the recording. Me, I prefer to do my own recording, because that means I've got, well, not simply evidence, that I actually gave a talk that I can give to my administrators to prove that I didn't just go on a vacation to Bali or something. But also, I have something that I can refer to people later on to give them if I can't give them a full talk. When you're recording, it changes the dynamics. Here I am giving you a talk here today, but when I'm giving you a talk, that changes if I'm recording the talk at the same time. And I think people who've done a lot of recording know this and recognize this, because you're speaking to more than one audience. I'm aware, and you really have to feel it to believe it. I'm aware as I stand here that I'm speaking not just to all of you, but to an audio audience as well. And so a lot of the time when I make remarks, my remarks are directed not just at the people in the room, but the people, I don't know, 10 years from now, 100 years from now, who knows, right? Depends on how good this recording is, I guess. And, you know, it results in you approaching the subject a bit differently. If the video camera is on, I was thinking of doing a video, but I don't have the batteries for it, so I didn't do a video today, but I often do video as well. And again, that changes entirely as well, your presentation, because now you're playing to the audience, you're playing to the camera, you're playing to the audio recording, and so on. But also, too, when you mix the things together, you mix the live audience, the recorded audience, the online audience, then you have multiple channels of communication. Things change that way as well. That's what I was trying to demonstrate here. Instead, we had multiple channels of tech breakdown. But nonetheless, when you have something like this going and something like this going, and, you know, if I really had it my own way, and I'm going to do this, I've done this in the past, I have the in-person channel, the online internet people channel. So I've got people all over the place taking part in this. So the idea here is instead of having just one single narrow focus of attention in a classroom, you have a number of different things going on. And that's an experience that parallels the experience that people have when they're online. But anyhow, it's not 10 reasons because I'm much better than David Letterman. I have... maybe it's 15, maybe 16 reasons why you should use the internet in the classroom. And believe me, we need motivation to integrate the internet in the classroom. Reason number one, because the school library only has 12 books from this century. Realistically, books are expensive. Some of them are really expensive. Educational books are very, very expensive, and they're getting more expensive. There's no sign that this price curve is turning around, right? If we want to get learning materials into the hands of students at a price that they can afford and we can afford, so all of you can get laptops, because you can't afford laptops, then we have to be looking at digital materials. We have to be looking at digital texts. We can quite literally put all of knowledge, everything, into the hands of students for the price of a couple of textbooks. I go out these days buying those memory cards. I'm sure you've all seen them. I think the different name, jump drive. I don't like that name. Thumb drive sounds awkward. Zip drive doesn't seem right. USB drive sounds technical. They didn't brand those well. But anyhow, you can get 8 gig ones now for like under $100. 8 gig is an awful lot of text. And there are projects out there, numerous projects now, that are dedicated to making available materials, learning materials for free. You're probably all familiar with the Gutenberg project, which is a long-standing project now. It's been going for something like 20 years to digitize famous books. There are also various open educational resource initiatives, and if you do a Google search on OER, you'll find these are being launched by organizations like UNESCO and OECD. And again, these are projects generally funded by foundations like Hewlett to create learning materials that can be freely shared. Rice University has a thing called Connections, Connexions, which is a place where teachers and instructors can go. And you use their software, you create a course right on their system, and then when you hit the submit button, the full course is made available to anybody to use for free. And then, of course, everybody's heard of Wikipedia, but there are other wiki-type initiatives to produce open materials, things like Curriki, C-U-R-R-I-K-I, and Wikiversity, spelled like it's pronounced, and one sponsored by the Commonwealth of Learning, based in Vancouver, called Wiki Educator. And that's notable because they just had their first elections for board members about 2 weeks ago. And so they're becoming more international and less Commonwealth only. So that's a key reason to use the Internet, right? We can and we are putting educational resources on the Internet for free use for everybody in the world. We can save on the cost of textbooks. Reason number two. Czechoslovakia is no longer a country. Now, actually, if you went to your school library, you'll probably find it there in just about every resource that's in the library, because Czechoslovakia stopped being a country not too long ago, after you acquired most of your books. The thing with events these days is that they change faster than we can print them in publications. You're probably familiar with many of the examples. Czechoslovakia is a good one. Yugoslavia, land of the southern Slavs, is now Croatia and Bosnia and Serbia and all the rest of them. Pluto, no longer a planet. Can you believe it? Me, personally, I belong to the group Make Pluto a Planet Again, because I'm stubborn that way. But the point is here, events change faster than our print publications, and if you want to use resources that are up to date and relevant, then you want to use online resources. Reason number three. I'm going to run out of fingers. Not everybody can tour Mongolia. The neat thing about the Internet is students can see things from around the world much more clearly than they could just from books or paper being told about it. One of the things I do, for example, it was mentioned that I travel, and I do travel. I'm not the only person in the world who travels. Lots of people travel. What lots of people do when they travel is they use services like Google Maps to find out what things are going to be like before they get there. Now, you don't have to be going someplace to get good use out of Google Maps. Looking at Mongolia through Google Maps is a completely different experience from reading about Mongolia in a book, because you're seeing what Mongolia actually is like. And it's good for students to be able to see these things. It's good for students to be able to see maps of the place, photographs of the place, blogs from people who live in the place, especially if you do things like tie that information in with current events that are happening now. For example, Iceland went broke last week. Okay, well, that's kind of interesting. But Iceland went broke last week, and we can look in Google Maps at the little roads that go around in the little towns, and that's the place that went broke. And now you're seeing the same story, but differently. Or Iceland went broke, and you can go read an Icelandic newspaper. Now, there's English translations of Icelandic newspapers, so it's not all in Icelandic. But even if it was, you'd be able to see it. So you can tie in knowledge of local geography with world events and tie that in with things that are happening here. Reason number four. Nobody here speaks Kazakh, and I looked it up. Kazakh is a real language. Well, I wasn't sure. The Internet provides you an unparalleled way of doing language training, and specifically, you can practice language with people who actually speak that language. I remember when I was learning French when I was in school, and the only other people that I was around me that I was learning French with were English speakers, and so they spoke French with a heavy English accent. So I learned French with a heavy English accent, and now when I speak French, it's with a heavy English accent and with bad grammar, because I didn't have good grammar either. Today, we have the opportunity, particularly with audio technology such as Skype and other conferencing tools, Illuminate or Adobe Connect even, although it's not my first choice. You can actually have conversations with people who speak in other languages. And there are sites online such as Spanish Pod and Chinese Pod that use Web 2.0 technologies to accelerate your language training. They do things like send you regular audio updates. They do things like connect you with speakers of the other language they do things like have you create resources in that other language. There's actually a project based right here in Charlottetown, being run by Mike McAdam, called Extemporal. You're nodding, which means you know the name of the product. For the life of me, I can't remember this morning. Pardon? Chula? Yeah, that's why I can't remember the name of the project. Product. He changed the name of it. Used to be called. Anyhow, yeah. But there is such an initiative, and you know, this is a side thing, right? So there is such an initiative right here in Prince Edward Island. It used to be called Koala, and that's not the first name it had either. So, but just as an aside, if you're starting an online business, pick a name, go with it. Okay. Italki is another one of these, and there's more, and that's a link. This presentation, by the way, will be available on my website, and if you click that link, you can go to another presentation that is exclusively on language training on the Internet. And there's all kinds of language training on the Internet. It's just exploded recently. It's amazing. Reason number five, nobody else on the football team is into macrame. You know how hard it is to find macrame footballs? You can't. I tried. But what you can do with the Internet is look up and learn about subjects that aren't widely interesting around here, around your own community, around your own neighborhood. One of the eye-opening experiences for me was a story by Claire Brooks. Claire Brooks works in Western Australia. She would talk about going up and down the sheep stations in Western Australia and talking with people about the different interests that they had. And there were people who would work in Western Australia who were interested in knitting, which kind of makes sense. It's taking me this long to put that together, but anyhow. But they were interested in knitting. Nobody else in their community was interested in knitting. But when the Internet arrived in their community, all of a sudden they were able to connect with other people around the world who were interested in knitting. And you see that a lot. When I was working in Manitoba with Assiniboine Community College, we set up an online course on world politics. And the reason for that was the schools in southwestern Manitoba, they're small schools, 100, 200, 300 students. They can't do a course in world politics. There's no way. But we had a course in world politics that we offered out of the Brandon Adult Learning Center, and we offered that to high schools across Manitoba. And so, we had one student here, two students there, taking world politics. And so we were able to serve this niche interest. And then I'm always reminded of the one lone goth who lives in Minnedosa. And Minnedosa is a Manitoba prairie town of, I don't know, 1,000 people. If you imagine yourself being the only goth in Minnedosa, you can see the value of the Internet and bringing the Internet into that person's life. I just don't know. How do you become the only goth in Minnedosa? But it's kind of interesting. Number six. Anybody can be Napoleon. All kinds of pictures of Napoleon online. Of course, the Internet allows you to get right into the environment, right into the situation. It allows you to immerse yourself in contemporary events, into world events. It allows you to see things from different perspectives, different contexts, different points of view. And there's all kinds of ways of doing this. Of course, the earliest, most common use of computer technology was for pilot training and flight simulators, and these now have become very sophisticated. Canadian military uses simulations extensively, and I've been to Gagetown and had the opportunity to play with some of their simulations, including their helicopter, and I currently hold the record on the Gagetown helicopter, the fastest crash. I actually did lift off, but that was only a technicality. Simulation and virtual environment, people are doing incredibly interesting things with Second Life. I'm I'm sure you've all heard of Second Life, and there's a couple of groups out there. Second Life in Education, or SLED. If you look at Second Life SLED on Google, you'll find these people. Jocadia is a Second Life community of educators. And people now are creating in Second Life things like virtual molecules. You walk and you tour the molecule from the inside, and all kinds of things where it's a way, again, of visualizing things from a different point of view, visualizing things that you might not have the opportunity to see on a day-to-day basis, on an offline basis. And then my favorite, Civilization. Civilization is a video game. It's about conquering the world. That's why I love it, because I get to conquer the world. I always go for the world conquest or world destruction options. There's a way you can conquer the world, right? Cultural conquest. Yeah, right. I've never won by cultural conquest. But there are projects that take civilization. The program can be adapted, or as the word goes, modded. And you can mod civilization to meet your own particular needs. So you can change all the characters, change the historical simulations, change the rules of the game. And what's interesting about this is not that you can mod civilization, but more to the point, your students can mod civilization. And what happens is when they mod the game, they see what a change in the conditions does to the gameplay. They see that if you change the weather, well, no, there's no weather in civilization, but if you change the terrain, then that changes the way wars are fought. If you change the rate at which civilizations can discover new technologies, that changes your strategy. And so these are ways of allowing students to see how one thing causes another. 7. Speaking in front of an audience is motivating. Very motivating. Not just for you, although it does help you, but also for your students. One of the things that the internet brings to your classroom is the rest of the world, which means that your students can do things that are viewed by the rest of the world. And the projects that I've seen thus far that involve this aspect of internet communications have resulted in students being much more motivated. Clarence Fisher, who works in northern Manitoba, for example, he writes a blog called Remote Access. And he talks about having students do blogs that other people can read, having students do presentations that people can see, and they become more motivated, they become more engaged in the work that they're doing when they understand and when they realize that people around the world can see this. At a call St. Joseph in Quebec City, I was talking to them a number of years ago, and they told me about the time Circus came through town. And students, grade 6 students from the school, went to see the circus, which is cool. And they come back home, and the students write a blog about the time of the circus. Gets posted up, anybody in the world can see it. A week goes by, someone from the circus writes a reply. Now, that's an eye-opening experience. All of a sudden, that student realizes that they're not just writing for their teacher. They're not just writing for their friends. They're writing for quite literally anybody, and you can be very sure the next time they review the show, they're extra careful about how they review that show. 8, collaboration on the test is no longer cheating. Well, maybe it is, in many cases it is, but it shouldn't be, should it? Collaboration and teamwork skills are the new math these days. Well, we still need math, but we also need collaboration and teamwork skills. And these can be practiced in class, but if your classes are like the classes that I went to when I was in school, everyone knows everyone, right? So you're collaborating with people you already know. But if you're working online, if you're creating projects with people from other cities, what you have to do is start the collaboration from scratch. You don't have this knowledge that you're already working from. You have to negotiate from a position where you don't know what their background values are, you don't know what their objectives are. They might even speak a different language. It's very interesting trying to collaborate through Google Translator, but it can be done. It's a lot better because it's a lot more challenging to learn about collaboration with people from other countries and other communities. Number 9, instant messaging is cheaper than SMS. So I'm not sure that's true anymore. It was true last year, but now you can get these SMS all you want packages, although those aren't cheap either. Anyhow, the point is, students are attached to their cell phones. They're attached to communication. They want to communicate. They want to communicate back and forth. And there are two ways they can do this. They can do this out of the context of learning, or they can do it inside the context of learning. If they're using the internet, the same internet that they're using to do their classes or to read textbooks or to practice in simulations, if they're using that environment to communicate, now their communication is happening in the same context as their learning. And that means that their communication and their learning begin to intertwine. They begin to reflect each other. The communication becomes about their learning. Number 10, you Google them, they Google you. That in itself is just worth keeping in mind for two reasons. First of all, obviously, you can Google your students. How many of you have Googled your students? None. One. Well, with two hands. My question, why not? Why wouldn't you? You're not violating their privacy. They put it up in a public space. You can Google your students and then surprise them in class by showing that you know what they've done online. There's a life lesson for you, especially if it's one of those, and yeah, we'll get to that. The other thing is, even if you're not Googling them, they're Googling you. So if you had a really good time in New Orleans last year and took pictures, anyhow, I'm just kidding, but they're Googling you. They're probably chatting about you. They maybe not for K-12 classes, but certainly for higher levels. They may be putting a review on ratemyprofessor.com. How many of you Google yourself? A few. The rest of you, when you go back home, or even when you get internet access again, Google yourself. Just to see what's there. Because if your students are talking about you, in many cases, you'll be able to find that through Googling. You know what's worse? If they're not talking about you. Doing this, not just using Google, but using the other services, Yahoo or Flickr or even YouTube or the Internet Archive, even Wikipedia, first of all, it's a good way for you to do research online, but even better, when you use these services, you should use them openly. You should use them in front of the classroom. If it was me, if I was in the same class, you know, pretty much every day, I'd have a Google station. And when I needed to know something, I'd Google it. And I wouldn't just use Google, but basically I'd have the internet research station with a screen or something like that, right? And pretty much any time somebody in the class wanted to research something, you just walk over to the Google station and research it. The idea here is not simply to use the technology to do research. Anyone can do that. But what you want to do is use the technology to do research in an environment such that the students are watching you use the technology to do research. Because the important thing isn't the doing of the research. The important thing is the how to do the research. And when you're doing the research in front of them, you are showing them how to do the research. You're showing them how to use Wikipedia. Everybody says, don't just quote Wikipedia. Well, okay, well, that's fine. Don't just quote Wikipedia. What then? Well, you go to the Wikipedia page. You find out the basic information from Wikipedia. Then you follow up the references. Then you take terms, put the terms into a Google search. You do a Google search. You do that sort of thing. Wikipedia can be used in research, and you can show students how to use it in research, and it gives them an alternative to trying to hide the fact that they've gone to Wikipedia. There's another site, I just ran it in my newsletter yesterday, called Exploratorium, and I didn't have a chance to go in deeply into it, but actually exploratorium is the main site. The actual specific site is called Evidence. And it's one of these sites, it's focused on archaeology, which is pretty cool. And so it's got, like, you know, lots of graves and bones and things like that that are kind of gross. So it'll probably appeal to students. But it also talks about how archaeology research is conducted, the methods they use, and there's even a display of an academic paper, the different elements of the academic paper, and how those tie back to the work that we did with the bones. Really cool stuff. You can find all kinds of examples of how to do research online. Number 11. You should learn something about Facebook. How many of you have been to Facebook? Almost all of you. How many of you have a Facebook page? Oh, that's pretty good. How many of you go to it every day? Wow, that's almost a quarter of you. Well, I'm impressed. Yeah, you should. That's actually quite a bit better than I expected for a group that didn't bring their computers here. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Yeah, you should learn something about Facebook, but more importantly, your students should learn something about Facebook as well. And it's good that so many of you are using Facebook. The rest of you should, because students are using these social networks, not just Facebook, but also Bebo and Orkut and MySpace and all the rest of them. There's a whole pile of them. Hilo? Sorry? Twitter? Twitter, yeah, they love Twitter. I'm kind of ambivalent, but then again, I have a Twitter account and I use it, so, but I don't follow anyone. I've had comments about that, but, anyhow, it's all a very complex environment out there. You need to be in it to understand it. Doesn't mean you need to know everything. Nobody can know everything, but you need to have a sense, right? And you need to have some idea of what your students are up to. Again, those of you who didn't Google your students, how many of you tried to look up your students on Facebook? Couple? Pardon? Well, do it from home. Yeah. For those of you who have blocked Facebook at school, it raises the interesting question how you're going to use it at school in order to look up students and the rest. It's a little of an off-topic issue, but I don't think that you're helping students learn about Facebook by blocking it, because they are still using it. I'll bet you almost every one of your students has an account on Facebook, and they just do it at home. And if it's blocked at school, then you should, I hate to say this, because who wants to take their work home with them, but use your home computer or the library computer if it's not blocked there, and access Facebook from there. Look it up. They do, but it's more commonly blocked than used. It's more commonly a place where students go and do their thing. And this is the thing about blocking Facebook, right? Blocking Facebook doesn't block the students. It blocks the teachers, which is kind of an odd sort of thing. But, yeah. Pardon? I agree. And there's a long list of things that get blocked. You know, and it's a multifaceted question, because it's not simply the fact that these things block, but it's also the question of who makes these decisions, on what grounds they make these decisions, and so on. Are these educational decisions, or is somebody in computer services saying, too much trouble? Why are they blocking Skype? They're probably blocking Skype. How are you going to do Skype casts with people in Mongolia if Skype is blocked? Students need to use these technologies. They need to use these technologies in an environment where there is somebody who can offer them some guidance, some model of proper behavior, some support, and even some monitoring and supervision as necessary. If you don't show students the appropriate way of using Facebook or MySpace or whatever, they're not going to learn. They'll learn the inappropriate ways, which the evidence suggests massively is what they're learning at the moment. Number 12. How am I doing on time? have a minute. 8 points. Just kidding. Nobody uses trigonometry on the bus. I've seen school buses. They're generally not doing recreational trig. Students are always saying things like, why should we learn trigonometry? Why should we learn differential calculus or whatever? And in the everyday life of a student, it just doesn't come up. But on the internet, it does come up. And it comes up in amazing, interesting, unexpected ways. This is something that Seymour Papert and Marvin Minsky knew many years ago at Media Lab at MIT when they developed things like Squeak and Smalltalk to get students involved and interested in programming. Me, my own background, this is my own story, I did not learn trigonometry in high school, despite their best efforts to teach me. I did not learn trigonometry at Algonquin College, despite their best interest to teach me, their best efforts to teach me. I did not learn trigonometry at the University of Calgary, even though I took Remedial Math 101. No, I learned trigonometry a number of years later when I was messing around trying to build the perfect Star Trek game. And one of the things I wanted to do in the perfect Star Trek game was have a view screen. Have spaceships on the view screen and have the spaceship turn around and take off. How do you make a spaceship on a view screen turn around and take off? Well, you need trigonometry because you're rotating an object. And you need to know what the lengths are of all the little lines when you're rotating an object. And that's when I learned trigonometry. When you're doing things like programming computers, a lot of this really useless junk comes up and is very useful to you. And that is the context where they stop saying, why do I need to learn trigonometry? And they start saying, can you teach me about trigonometry, please? Just on the side, because I know we're doing something else now, but I really need it. There's the great book, it was called Rocket Boys, and then later on it was called October Sky. By Homer Higgins, is it? Yes. Who ended up working for NASA. And his story is of building rockets as a kid. I built rockets as a kid, too, but very badly. So actually what I built were small explosions. But they had access to a machine shop, so they could build nozzles and things like that. And they ended up teaching themselves, at least according to the book and according to the movie, ended up teaching themselves the mathematics of combustion and propulsion, teaching it themselves in order to make their rockets launch. And so, again, it's this sort of doing these interesting projects, not necessarily online, but you can see how something like this would have been greatly aided with support from online research. Which leads to 13. Learning to code could save the world. You may have heard of the film War Games, where two kids almost start World War III by hacking on computers. Well, that's only one of the things that you can do only with the internet. There are many things that you can only do on the internet. You can learn programming in the classroom. You can learn programming on your own computer. But there are types of programming you can only learn if you're doing internet programming. Programming that involves users, for example. Programming that involves services or connections with remote web services. Students in general who code, and especially students in general who code things like websites and online services, learn very quickly the need for their other subjects. They learn very quickly that they need English, if only for their documentation or if only for the words that show up on the screen. They learn very quickly they need things like art and design. These aren't useless topics to them. These are fundamental skills that you need in today's business world. And, of course, they learn about mathematics and the other things that they need in order to make a computer program operate properly. Minsky and Papert thought, and I think as well, that learning to program a computer is a basic skill. Not that programming a computer is a basic skill, but programming a computer is essentially logic. And logic is a basic skill. Now, I sometimes get called a prickly analytic. And partly that's because of my training in philosophy, but a big part of that is because I've done so much computer programming. Computer programming teaches you to be precise. It teaches you to use terms very carefully, because if you don't define your term, you don't know what's going to end up in your term, and that will create, as they say, random results in your computer program. That's the kind of thing that you learn when you're doing computer programming. You learn a precision that you might not learn in other ways. Number 14, this one's for you. Teachers need somebody to talk to. That's why you're all here, right? It's a day out of the class, thank goodness. Somebody to talk to, somebody to have a coffee with. Yeah, I know, there's the staff room. Same five people every 5 days. Anyhow, the internet is for the benefit of the teachers, too, probably more than anything else. And like I said at the start of this talk, I have another talk where I talked exclusively about using the internet for your own teaching and learning. Forget about the students. This is how to conduct your own professional development, to take into your own hands your own learning, your own training. Teaching can be lonely. Teaching is a really hard way, it's a really hard job to get professional development on because you're not really that often exposed to what other teachers are doing. You're in your class and they're in their class and there's walls between you. But being online makes it possible for you to engage with other teachers, not just in your school, not just in your province, but around the world. And what many teachers are doing today is creating projects or collaborations with other teachers around the world. There's a couple of them. The Flat Classroom Project is one that's being run by some teachers out of the States. There's the course that George Siemens and I are teaching online called Connectivism and Connective Knowledge. And again, for George and I, this is a way for George and I to work together, which is something we could not do without the internet to connect us. And the course is just the context in which we work together. 15, it gets students out of the class. I know that sounds like the greatest aim of every teacher. Actually, it is the aim of every teacher, isn't it? But more to the point, this comes back to the technology is blocked. The school, it seems these days, is the only place that doesn't have internet, or certainly doesn't have access to the good stuff. We have wireless internet on our city buses in Moncton. And if we can have wireless access on our buses, we should have access in the schools. And more to the point, we should have our schools in places where there is wireless access. Now that students can access learning, can access communication, can access everything they need, really, for an education online, why do we keep them in a small little room with too little oxygen and not enough light? Why don't we get them out into the community? Why don't we have students learning about forestry in a forest, learning about agriculture on a farm, learning about law in a courtroom? Students could be doing this, and I think will be doing this, more and more frequently as time goes by, because they can keep connected, not just to learn about stuff, not just to get information while they're in these places, but while they're in these environments, they can use things like their camera phones or digital video recorders or any of these other things to actually begin to interact with that environment, to record that environment. Remember I said at the start, like everyone's got a camera these days. Everything you do is recorded these days. Well, it's these students out there in the community doing this recording more and more. I was walking down Queen Street just yesterday, and there's this a young woman, I don't know, high school, college age, just sort of on the terrace of the library. She got her camera gear there and tripod. I have no idea what she was doing, but she's doing something, recording something, and you see that more and more. If you watch for it, you see people taking videos, taking photos, videoing themselves, creating documentaries. If you don't see it around your community, look for it online. Look for it on Flickr, where there's tens of millions of photographs that people are taking. Look for it at YouTube, where there's again, millions of videos. Students more and more outside the class are interacting with their environment, and if we make interaction with that environment part of their actual official education, we can take the best of both worlds. We can take the world of learning, where there's support, advice, etc., and technology and community, I guess that's three worlds, not both worlds, and bring them together and create a new type of learning, a much more interesting type of learning. Now, this was a talk about why to use the internet in the classroom, but it was also, at the same time, a talk about how to use the internet in the classroom. Because what we want to do with the internet is the sort of thing that the internet uniquely can do. Like playing basketball, that was perfectly good with a court and a ball. You don't need the internet for that. But things that only, well, I guess with the Wii now, you can do it. And then never mind. They're actually talking in our office about getting an office Wii, so I'm totally in favor. How many of you have a Wii in your school? How many of you have a Wii? Yeah. Get a Wii. I'm not paid by Nintendo, but this is computing that goes beyond typing and pictures and that and actually gets you interactive. Anyhow. This is a talk not just about why to use the internet, but how to use the internet in the classroom. How do you use it? Use it to access current materials, current reference materials, current educational materials. Use the internet to integrate current events with today's lesson plan. Use the internet to broaden students' experiences, to actually have them look and see other countries, other cultures. Support language learning with online conversations with people who actually speak that language. Use the internet to encourage niche interests. Go out and Google your students, find out what they're interested in, use the internet, get stuff, get them connected to people who are interested in that, screen them first. Find and plan simulations and immersions that extend their learning. Lots of stuff on the internet for that. Have students present stuff online. Build collaborative exercises, projects, web quests, whatever, where students are working together, not just with the people in the same room, but with people around the world. Build communication into learning. Have them talking to themselves, having talking among themselves, even as your own talk is going on. They will, of course, have to have internet access to do that. Use the internet to find out about students. Use the internet to find out what students are finding out about you. Spend time in social networks. Spend time in class in social networks. You know, this is an aside, but some of my most eye-opening experiences have been silly, random web play. Back in the days when people were just creating websites, I would just go to Yahoo, personal websites, random. And I'd go to random personal websites. Fabulous. Then later on, LiveJournal, find a random blog. Do that. I just go from random thing to random thing. These days I can look at random videos on YouTube, random photographs on Flickr. And again, it's a way of simply opening your eyes. You don't know what you're going to see when you do that, but you do know you're going to see a little bit of everything. Support deep learning with deep projects. You can give students really difficult projects. Give them 2 years to do it, but you can give them really difficult projects, or even better, have them find really difficult projects, or even better, help them and support them in the really difficult projects that they've already undertaken and are doing on their own time. Build your own personal learning networks. That means subscribing to discussion lists, those of you who may not have. That does mean having accounts on Facebook or MySpace or whatever. It means writing blogs or reading blogs. It means connecting with other people in any way possible, anywhere from instant messaging to email to web blogs to artwork to whatever is interesting to you. Integrate students into the community. Find out what's happening in the community. Find ways to get your students involved in what's happening in the community. There are some other papers I've written on related topics, and you can find all of that and this presentation sometime later today at downs.ca. And that's my talk, and I thank you for your time and your attention.
Thank you, Stephen, for taking the trek over here today to talk to us.
My pleasure.
You've certainly opened our eyes, and no doubt Kirk as well came into play for this thing, and we know what technology is like. But you've really given us food for thought, and we want to thank you for your presentation.
Oh, thank you. It's an envelope. I've always wanted one.
Before we go on break, there's a few little things I want to take care of. Break will be served now immediately following this presentation. Just out here in the lobby, there's refreshments, food, and a drink. And right after, we're going to do our carousel. And that involves six